All right, let's jump right into the review. So the test is 70 multiple choice questions. There is no FRQ for this one. You've done a lot of FRQ practice. I didn't feel the need to give you an FRQ for this. So you're just going to take multiple choice. And it is made up of questions from across the board, all of our units that we have done. If you see a topic on this review, then that topic is probably going to be on the test. So you can feel pretty confident that by studying this review, you're studying for the test, and there's not going to be any whole bunch of extras and things like that. And my wife is coming down. It sounds like talking on the phone. So if she does, I apologize. All right, so let's get going. So five, and I'm just looking at my notes. So that's what I'm looking at. I don't have the review like sharing. Anyways, 5.11, the language acquisition for older individuals. So just recognize and realize it gets more difficult as you get older to learn a new language. You know, it's much easier when you're a kid and younger and a teenager and things like that to acquire knowledge. And it's all the different cognitive stuff going on. I think I've told you all throughout, maybe not throughout class, but I think I've told you that I'm doing Duolingo trying to learn Spanish. And I think I can read it much better than I can process it and say stuff. And I don't know if that has something to do with this, but like if you give me a written phrase in Spanish, I can kind of sort out the stuff at this point. However, if you were to start talking to me, unless you talk super slow, I might not get everything. And I definitely probably can't respond because it just takes a while for me to process everything. Anyways, long story to say, hey, it's harder for old people. Okay. And I'm an old person. 5.7, learning one way, but then things change. Very kind of broad topic here. A very weird one. But basically, when we learn a specific way of doing something, but then things change, we have specific cognitive things that kind of fire off, and will kick in to help us make the adjustments. And sometimes those cognitive things, and I'm being very general here, sometimes those cognitive firings in our brain work really well, and we adjust, and we're boom, we go. Other times, it takes us a long while. Okay, like math nowadays, math is taught so different from when I was a kid and when I was learning it. So, trying to help my youngest in third grade, I'm flashing back to the third grade. She's in seventh grade now, but when I was trying to help her in third grade, it's like, why are you doing it this way? And it took me a while to figure out what to do. Aptitude tests. These are going to measure a person's potential to perform well in particular areas. And the different aptitude tests will measure different things. It might be something measuring your academic skills. It might be measuring your vocational skills, your aptitude for the military, or whatever the test might be. There's all kinds of achievement and aptitude tests out there. Probably the biggest ones, the most famous ones, the ones you're probably most familiar with, are going to be like the SAT and the ACT. 5.4, the kinds of learning, ability to recall info in reverse order. So this is going to be the memory that involves the conscious recall of factual information such as names, dates, and events, right? And the ability to recall that in reverse order is a cognitive skill related to our working memory, which is that temporary storage and manipulation. So remember, you have short-term and long-term memory, and all those sorts of things. And this is going to play into that. And I have a fear of being asked to recall stuff in reverse order because I literally can't do it. Like if someone says, hey, say your ABCs in reverse order, I'll get Z, but then after that, I draw a blank. So anyways, there's that. 5.2, first stage in memory processing. So that's encoding. Remember that from unit five. And that involves the initial perception and interpretation of sensory information and the transformation of that information into a form that can be stored in memory. So that encoding is a big thing because you got to get to that step to help you start remembering. 5.1 is implicit memories. Those are memories that are formed and retrieved unconsciously or automatically without the need for conscious effort or awareness. They are often acquired through repeated experiences and are expressed through behavior, skills, habits, and emotional responses. Think about like you smell something and it takes you back to your grandma's house or whatever it might be. Okay. 5.5, the way information is presented. Very, 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 very broad topic here. And I know that. But this refers to the manner in which information is presented or communicated to individuals and how it can influence their understanding, their processing, and things like that. So things like clarity, organization are going to impact how well we learn and memorize things. 5.8. Looking back at events and thinking what best to do in hindsight. So we got the hindsight stuff going on here. Remember, there's something called hindsight bias, where we, and I'd like to think I'm not guilty of it, but I probably am, where we look back at events and we think, well, we should have done this, or this, we knew this was going to happen. Why didn't we plan for it, or whatever it might be? And so it's so easy to do. Like, it's easy to sit there and say, well, hey, if we'd just done this, well, yeah, now I have all the information. At the time, I didn't have all that information, or the person didn't have all that information. So that is what that is. All righty. 5.8, belief, perseverance. That is the tendency for people to cling to their initial beliefs or opinions. So, like if you heard that back in the COVID pandemic time that masks weren't really good, then maybe you clung to that no matter what you heard. Okay. And you just refuse to wear a mask because of that. And I'm not, hopefully I'm not getting on anybody about anything. I'm just, it's just the first thing that popped in my head. Maybe whatever. Okay. Any number of things. Maybe you heard that the flu vaccine doesn't work. And so now you refuse to get the flu vaccine, even though there's data that shows, hey, the flu vaccine works. Okay. That's all that is. Cerebellum, that's the part of the brain that's located beneath the cerebral hemispheres, and it's involved in our motor coordination. So, me doing my hand signals for whatever reason, I talk with my hands a lot of times. That's coming from that part of the brain. All right, unit 6.3, object permanence. So, that's the understanding that objects continue to exist even when they're not visible or present in the immediate environment. And so, this typically starts, we start to figure this out really young. About a year old or so, and that comes from Jean Piaget's theory of cognitive development. But we start to realize that, hey, there's other things happening. So, like for me, my mom and my sister and nieces and nephews are down in Florida. I'm up in Georgia, and I know they're living their lives, and I know things are happening. Even though I'm not there, they're still doing things. It's, you know, that's all that's getting at. 6.7, gender roles. Gender roles are those societal expectations and norms regarding how people should act just because they're a guy or a girl or whatever it might be. All right. And you know, if we go back into the like the 50s, all right, the societal or the gender roles was like the woman, the mom's gonna stay home, the man's gonna go out and make money, work and do that kind of stuff. 6.5, Erikson's stage of development. So Erik Erikson proposed a theory of psychosocial development, alrighty, and put it basically into different stages, and they span from childhood, birth, even infancy, whatever, through old age. Okay, and so that is what we're looking at here is those stages of development and what we get in each stage. So, like the fifth stage, and hopefully this is just triggering things for you. The fifth stage, that's the identity versus role confusion. And it's where we're trying to kind of figure out our purpose and our identity. 6.4, adolescence, change of behavior. So adolescence, so y'all, is a period of a lot of things happening, both physically, cognitively, emotionally, just everything's going on in your development at this time. And so there can be all kinds of changes in behavior, attitude, your social relationships. Maybe you have new friends, maybe you're leaving your old friends behind. But it's all about the kind of the changes that are happening through your hormones, your peer influence, and whatnot. And this is where you might take some risks here because you're feeling some kind of way, and things like that. 6.1, developmental norms. So this refers to the typical patterns of growth, behavior, and milestones achieved by individuals at different stages and areas of development. So these are based on research of populations, and it's basically just the bench press, not the bench press, I'm not working out, the benchmarks of kind of where you are expected to be. Now, that doesn't mean anything. Like, I hear stories all the time of, well, this person was, you know, 5'4" in 10th grade, and then all of a sudden they were 6'5" when they graduated high school. So, you know, just because you're not at a certain benchmark physically, mentally, whatever it might be, at when it's supposed to be, that doesn't mean you're not going to get there and you're not going to blow past it. Mary Ainsworth, excuse me, strange situation experiment. She conducted this experiment for patterns and behaviors in infants and young children. It involved observing infants' reactions to being separated. So they were with people familiar, the parents, people like that, caregivers. And then they were taken from them and given to someone that was like a stranger. And she was looking at their reactions. And it is basically an attachment issue. Okay. Like, how attached are you as an infant and other people to, like, the primary people in their lives. All right. 6.3, Jean Piaget, cognitive process. So Piaget was a Swiss psychologist known for the theory of cognitive development. And that just basically describes how children actively construct their understanding of the world through the different stages. Okay. So Piaget is going to propose that there's cognitive development occurs throughout things like assimilation, accommodation, as we interact as children with our environment, and other people and things like that. I keep on saying things like that, so hopefully you know what I'm talking about. I apologize for not being more specific. 6.2, Diana Bomerand. Research on parenting styles and their effects on child development. Bomerand identified three main parenting styles: authoritative, authoritarian, and permissive. These styles differ in their levels of warmth, control, and responsiveness to needs, and they have been linked to various outcomes in children's behavior and self-esteem. So permissive is going to let people love their kids, but they're going to let them do more than the authoritative. And authoritarian is going to ask for control and want control of the child. 6.7, gender stereotypes, oversimplified and over-biased beliefs about the characteristics, roles, and behaviors associated with individuals based on their gender. So we already did this and already talked about this, but it is something that's still happening. 6.2, criticism of Freud and his psychosexual theory. So it's been criticized because it has an emphasis on sexual instincts and early childhood experiences as the primary determinant of personality development. He doesn't really take into account other things that happen to you other than your early childhood experience. And that's the biggest kind of criticism. Critics argue that his theory is overly reductionist and based on limited empirical evidence because it doesn't take into account things that happen to you after you get out of your early childhood. Alrighty. It's also not very inclusive and it's not very applicable to diverse populations. So, you know, and that Freud came up, was around in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So, you know, not the diversity that we have today in our world, like that you have localized. Like, it's I'm not trying to defend Freud. I'm just saying he probably wasn't even something to think about probably back then, to be honest with you. All right, 7. And I keep on watching the clock because I hope to get done in our Zoom time. But if I don't, I will finish up everything in the podcast. Okay. 7.1, cognitive dissonance theory. This was proposed by Fessinger. And he is going to post that individuals experience discomfort or tension when they hold conflicting beliefs, attitudes, or behaviors. And to reduce this, people may change their beliefs. So this is where, you know, hey, you're in a conversation and this person believes this. You're like, well, I don't believe that really, but you just kind of go with the flow and you say, yeah, I believe that. Yeah. 7.9, the 5-factor model of personality, FFM, or the big 5 personality traits. It's a framework for understanding personality that identifies 5 broad dimensions of personality: openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and emotional stability. And so they are going to be, so there, people will look at these used for patterns of behavior, thoughts, and emotions. 7.1, the theories of motivation. The theories of motivation seek to explain the psychological processes underlying why individuals engage in certain behaviors, pursue specific goals, and persist in their efforts over time. It can be intrinsic motivation, extrinsic, you know, I'm doing this for the reward, things like that. 7.6, theories of personality, taking out frustrations on others. So this concept relates to the psychoanalytic concept of displacement, which is a defense mechanism, basically. And individuals redirect their negative emotions towards something that is less threatening. So I would never do this, but like if you get angry and you go kick a pet, like a cat or something like that, that is what this is getting at. Don't do that. That is very mean. 7.10, assessment tools, personality. So this is going to be things like the Minnesota personality test, the Myers-Briggs, things like that, that are going to be tools. They're going to ask questions or ask you to look at things and tell you your experience or perceptions and whatnot to help with assessing your personality traits. 7.5, Albert Bandura, people who believe that their efforts will be successful and that they are in control of events. That's a very long topic there, so I apologize for that. He is going to study self-efficacy, basically, though, and that is our belief that our actions matter, and you know that what we do matters. And so, you know, like you watching this video and studying for this test, and you believe in that, hey, I'm going to do good because I did that. That's a high self-efficacy. If you're like, well, it doesn't matter if I watch this or if I listen to the podcast or things like that, I'm not going to do good. Anyways, that'd be low self-efficacy. So Albert Bandura is going to do that. And, you know, low self-efficacy leads to lower things because you're not going to try. Because, well, it doesn't matter what I do, I'm not going to be successful. Well, you're not even trying. 7.7, behaviorist method to increasing openness. So that involves things like desensitization, I can't say the word. Exposure therapy, behavioral experiments, trying to reduce anxiety. And it's based on, you know, classical and operant conditioning, which we'll get into a little bit later in the review. So I won't spend too much time on that. Okay. 7.5, validity of the big five personality traits. So these things have been studied pretty extensively, and they're pretty validated at this point. So there's still some questions. There still can be some questions, but for the most part, they have a rich history of being applied and being looked at, and there's a pretty big data set about them. 7.9, characteristics, the big five personality traits. So openness to experience, that's going to be curiosity, creativity, your imagination, things like that. Alrighty, I would probably say I don't have any creativity and I'm not very imaginative. Conscientiousness, organization, responsibility, self-discipline, things like that. I would say I have that. Extroversion, sociability, assertiveness, enthusiasm, energy. I definitely am not very social. Like, I don't like talking to people. I'm not super assertive. I just kind of go with the flow. So that's probably not me. Agreeableness, altruism, cooperation, empathy, kindness, interpersonal warmth, emotional stability, anxiety, moodiness, and things like that. So those are the characteristics of those big five. And I am trying to go quick because my Zoom runs out in about 20 minutes. So I want to be sure and get done as much as possible. 8, Aaron T. Beck, psychiatrist, psychotherapist, best known for developing cognitive theories, now known as cognitive behavioral therapy. He is going to basically look at the cognitive processes like thoughts, beliefs, and interpretations, and how that shapes our emotions and behaviors. It's going to be used to treat a whole bunch of psychological disorders like depression, anxiety, things like that. 8.4, indications of depression. You did a whole thing on this. It could be feelings of sadness, hopelessness, emptiness, loss of interest. You don't want to do anything. There's a whole line of things that can indicate depression. 8.5, somatotiform disorders are a group of psychological disorders characterized by physical symptoms or complaints that can't be fully explained by medical conditions. So think of like substance abuse, There are some mental health disorders that will come in here, but they are going to involve being preoccupied with the sensations or functions that come from the distress or impairment in functioning. Schizophrenia and the symptoms, severe chronic mental disorder characterized by hallucinations, disorganized thinking and speech, very disorganized behavior, things like that. A.9, treatments for disorganized thinking and communicating with people who do not exist. Very broad thing here. So this is going to involve antipsychotic medications, typically psychotherapy, and psychosocial interventions are going to be the big things that are going to help you with this. 8.8, anxiety hierarchy and relaxation as parts of the treatment. In anxiety treatment, there is a hierarchy of anxiety-provoking situations. So basically, hey, here's the least anxious or anxiety-provoking thing, saying hello, all the way up to trying to have a conversation or whatever it might be. They put you into these positions, and they each one gets more anxiety-inducing. 8.10, assumption of rational emotive therapy. That's developed by Albert Ellis, and it's that irrational beliefs and thoughts contribute to emotional distress and maladaptive behaviors. The goal is to identify and challenge irrational beliefs. So if you have some kind of irrational fear, maybe like, hey, maybe I'm scared of this wall that's in front of me. Really no reason for me to be scared. That's an irrational fear. So how are we going to handle that? And then last for 8, personality disorders. So antisocial symptoms. So the disorder it's a personality disorder, and it has pervasive pattern disregard for and violation of the rights of others, as well as a lack of empathy and remorse. So it can include being deceitful, impulsiveness, aggressiveness, irresponsibility, things like that. 9, instrumental aggression, that's also going to be predatory aggression, refers to aggression behavior that is purposely initiated to achieve a specific goal or outcome, like obtaining resources or asserting dominance. 9.1, evidence of the self-serving bias, that is a cognitive bias that leads individuals to attribute their success to internal factors like their own abilities or efforts while attributing their failures to external factors. So, hey, I just know things. I don't have to study. I don't have to prepare. Or, hey, I failed that test because the teacher's horrible or whatever it might be. 9.3, groupthink, a phenomenon that occurs when members of a group prioritize consensus and harmony over critical thinking. You may have been a part of a group like this where you just go along with the crowd. All righty. And that gets people in trouble when you don't think for yourself. 9.6, altruism, pro-social behavior characterized by selfless concern for the well-being of others, often invoking acts of kindness, generosity, and self-sacrifice. Big role in promoting social cohesion. 9.4, group influences refer to the ways in which individuals' thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are influenced by the presence, actions, or norms of groups which they belong or with which they interact. It can include social facilitation, conformity, so conforming to the group. 9.7, social psychology concept applies to a warm, loving relationship. Very long, very broad. So this is going to be the reciprocatory principle. I can't say it. I even slowed down and tried to say it, and I just could not spit it out. I'm so sorry. But when you get things for other things, alrighty. And this suggests that people tend to respond to kind and loving gestures with similar kind and loving gestures. So basically, if you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you. 9.3, experiments of Solomon Ash. He conducted experiments on conformity in the 1950s, where people had to make judgments about the length of lines in the presence of Confederates who gave incorrect answers. They found that many participants conformed just because they didn't want to be seen as going against the group. Now, we talked about this in a sync session. 9.5, the mere exposure effect. This is a psychological phenomenon that refers to the tendency for people to develop a preference for stimuli that they've been exposed to repeatedly or familiar with, even if they're not consciously aware of the exposure. All righty. 9.1, attribution theory. Attribution theory is a social psychology theory that examines how individuals explain the causes of behavior, events, or outcomes, both in themselves and others. So according to this, people can attribute causes to behavior based on internal and external factors. So think about like, hey, I did this because of this behavior of mine, because in my brain it did this, or external, hey, I'm just lucky. You know, I got lucky there. 9.3, foot in the door phenomenon. This is a compliance technique that involves making a small request or favor before making a larger request. So, hey, can I borrow 50 cents? And then next thing you know, I'm asking for $50 and then $500 and so on and so forth. Let me see what I can get from you. Okay, that is the semester two stuff. The Zoom has about 12 minutes or so. And I think I can get through the rest of it, but I'm going to stop the podcast and I'm going to start a new. Okay. So I think we can get through this, for unit one, 1.5, the frequency distribution shown in multiple graphs. So this is the patterns, or distribution of scores in a value or of value in a data set. And it can be visualized in all kinds of different graphs, histograms, bar graphs, and things like that. So that's, you're probably on the test going to see some kind of graph and have to sort out the information. 1.2, disadvantage of longitudinal studies. Remember, longitudinal studies, and I'm drawing that out there, involve collecting data over a extended period of time from the same group. Okay, so like if someone started following you in kindergarten and collecting data through now, that would be a longitudinal study. And a disadvantage is that people will possibly drop out, like maybe not even meaning to. They just drop out of the study. And that reduces the sample size. It also introduces bias into the data. Also participant fatigue. If you're doing it too much, you know, if you're having to do the same actions over and over and over, loss of interest, relocation, people pass away. There's a whole bunch of things there. 1.3, double blind control is essential. Four. So double blind control, that's where, neither the experiment, the person that's kind of working or doing the, or being the recipient, know who has gotten what. Okay. So that's it done to try and minimize bias and the placebo effect. So we don't want you to know that, hey, you're supposed to be taking this medicine. It's supposed to do this. Cause then you might, even if you're not getting the real thing, you might think it is and act like it is. And it's going to be really important in testing new medications and treatments. 1.1, advocates of nature and nature nurture controversy. So remember that that is going to boil down to basically growing up. Are you going to be away because of the you were born that way, nature, or were you nurtured into being that way? Okay. And really at this point, there's not anybody that's going to say, there's not too many people out there that are going to argue one way or the other. We have kind of come to the conclusion that is a mixture. You know, you're born a certain way, and then the environment you're around contributes to that as well. 1.6, the APA ethical guidelines. So the American Psychology Association provides all kinds of ethical guidelines for when we are conducting research. And the bottom line here is you're not supposed to harm any of your participants, whether that be through releasing their information that might be sensitive, doing experiments that are going to harm them. There's all kinds of things that are going to go into the APA guidelines. Unit two, who genetically determines a child's sex? It's determined by the combination of sex chromosomes inherited from the parents. Females are typically going to have two X chromosomes, while males will have one X and one Y. And typically the father's contribution determines the sex of the child, as they can provide either X or Y. 2.8, psychological effects of alcohol intake. Alcohol consumption can have various psychological effects on individuals depending on the factors about the amount consumed and things like that. But typically, alcohol is going to relax people, is going to make them happy for a while, and then it's a downer. Okay, it's going to bring people, and they're going to just kind of withdraw a little bit, maybe. 2.6, aphasia as a result of damage to which part of the brain? So that is a language disorder that occurs as a result of damage to a specific areas of the brain responsible for the language processing. So if you see that, just know it's a specific disorder that happens when people have a part of their brain damaged. And it's typically located in the left hemisphere of the brain for right-handed individuals. 2.3, polygraph machine measures what? So it is the lie detector. Okay, that's typically how we know it. And it measures our responses such as heart rate, blood pressure, and things like that when we are asked questions. And then, you know, there are changes when we lie. You know, our body, even if we're not meaning to, will kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Betray us if we're trying to tell a lie. They aren't used though in court. They're not so good that courtrooms are like, hey, yes, that's definite. 2.9, stops breathing repeatedly during sleep. That's going to be sleep apnea. Okay, where you basically can't breathe at some point and you wake up gasping for air. And this is a lot of times why people will, like, if they like, I slept all night, but they don't feel rested, is because they have bad sleep apnea where they're waking up constantly trying to get that breath. 3.2, the ability to focus on conversation in a noisy room. This refers to the cocktail party effect, which is where individuals can selectively attend to one conversation or sound source while filtering out other competing stimuli such as background noise. Some people are much better at this than others. You know, it can be tough sometimes to focus in on the one conversation. I attended prom last night for my face-to-face job, and it was loud. They had all kinds of stuff going on, and people were coming up and talking to me, and you know, I had to really focus hard on them and their conversation because you had other stuff distracting as well. And so that's the cocktail effect, cocktail party effect, not cocktail. 3.3. Perceptual principles. This is known as the Gestalt principles or organizer principles that govern how we perceive and interpret sensory information, particularly our visual stimuli. All right. And they can include Gestalt, which is the whole is perceived as more than the sum of its parts. Proximity. Objects are close to each other, are perceived as belonging together. Similarity, objects that are similar in appearance are perceived as belonging together. Continuity, I can't say it. I can't talk. It's continuous, is what I'm trying to say. Lines or shapes that are continuous or smooth are perceived as belonging together. And then figure ground, perceptual organization into a figure and the ground. If you remember back to the test, I know it's a long time ago, but there was a question about a kid and a dog and associating dogs with like being bitten or something like that. I can't remember exactly what the question was, but that's what this is coming from, where the kid was bitten by a specific dog and then he just associated all dogs with biting. 3.4, perception expectancy. This refers to the influence of expectations, beliefs, and prior experience on perceptual interpretation. So our expectations and past experiences shape how we perceive and interpret sensory information now. 3.1, cues to best be able to use judgment about the distant objects are. Depth perception is what we're talking about here, and that refers of the ability to perceive the relative distance of stuff. So like you hear nearsightedness, farsightedness, things like that. That's the stuff we're talking about there with our depth perception. And when people's depth perception is off, they have a hard time telling how far away something is. 3.6, super taster. That's an individual who has an unusually high density of taste buds on their tongue, leading to heightened sensitivity to taste sensations, particularly bitterness. So that's when they might into a lemon and they might be really super sensitive to that. Lastly, 4.3, shaping. That's a behavioral technique used in operant conditioning to gradually mold and reinforce complex behaviors by rewarding successive approximations toward a desired behavior. So shaping. So my wife has taught my dog, I have a new puppy, to roll over and things like that. She gives him a treat. We're shaping his behavior. 4.2, conditioned stimulus and unconditioned stimulus. So this is in classical conditioning. The conditioned stimulus is a neutral stimulus that through repeated pairing with an unconditioned stimulus comes to elicit a conditioned response, similar to the unconditioned response produced by the unconditioned stimulus. Alrighty, so it's all about how are we training, how are we shaping people's behavior, basically, with the conditioned and unconditioned stuff. 4.1, the mental image of a spatial layout. So that refers to the cognitive representation or internal mental map of a physical, environmental, or spatial configuration. This mental image allows us to mentally navigate and manipulate the information. Basically, if you're walking through your house at 3 a.m. and the lights are out, you probably remember, okay, the coffee table is in this general area, and you don't stub your toe on it. Or you remember that the couch is here, so on and so forth. That's all that's getting at. 4.1, particular group of brain cells seem to provide a basis for observational learning. That's going to be neurons, particular group of brain cells in the cortex, premotor cortex, and they are going to help us with our observational learning. And then finally, 4.3, the secondary reinforcer. That is also known as the condition reinforcer. It's a stimulus that gains reinforcing properties through association with primary reinforcers or are basically our learning. And these are going to be pretty rewarding. Okay. That's different from the primary reinforcers. Primary reinforcers are pretty like right now, like, okay, you did this, here's some food. Secondary is not going to be immediate, but it can be something that you can use, such as praise or money or something like that. All right, guys, best of luck on this test. Best of luck on all your tests. I said it in the email, but I wish you the best of luck in whatever part of your academic journey you're on. I appreciate getting to be a part of it. If I can ever do anything to help you out, please feel free to reach out. Please just let me know, and I will do what I can. If you have questions about the test, shoot me an email, but good luck. And have a great rest of your school year and rest of your summer. Take care. Bye-bye.